Welcome to my podcast, The School of Humanity, and the sixth episode on the impact of emergency work on personal relationships. I'm Marika, your host, humanitarian, globetrotter, international speaker, and so excited that you're tuning in. In conversations with fellow aid workers, you will hear a long list of issues that we're dealing with on a regular basis. Long working hours, management issues, loss of motivation, problems too big to solve, and painful events and trauma. But sooner or later, we start to talk about the main issue, relationships. And that's because we all desire consistent, reliable relationships. But the job, long working hours, many field missions, pressure to deliver under difficult conditions, can really undermine healthy social support structures and relationships. Mark Snelling, who is my today's podcast guest, is a psychotherapist and former aid worker himself, who discovered gardening as his passion after years of living abroad, suggests this in his research. Humanitarian work offers a powerful solution on a much more unconscious level to personal relationship insecurities. Humanitarian work takes the focus away from our own personal pain towards the needs of others. Mark, it's a pleasure to have you and welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me, Marika. It's great to be here.
You had your own journey of reflection where you realized that, yes, your decision was motivated by your wish to make a difference in the world when you joined the humanitarian sector. But you also realized that you might have had an unconscious pattern to find relief from your anxieties that you had. Is that what it really is? Is that why I also, you know, went from emergency to the next? Because I wanted to avoid relationship insecurities? Are we adrenaline junkies?
Big question there. I suppose yes and no, but I'll come back to that. I mean, I'll give you a little bit of background of how I got to where I've got to. I had been a journalist in the Far East, and I was really feeling that I wanted to do something that had more meaning for me. And so I looked around and I thought, oh, I know, the humanitarian sector looks like a good fit. And I was thrilled. I mean, it felt exactly right for me. And you know, I had all sorts of motives that I think were right. I mean, I wanted to make a difference. I wanted to make the world a better place. So off I went, joined the ICRC, as it happens, and started doing missions. Realized after not too long, though, that I was struggling emotionally. I think people relate to this, but certainly began to feel really very lonely. I mean, initially I'd felt that this was great. I was going to be traveling. I was going to go to interesting places. You know, I was feeling that I was making a difference. But things did begin to feel difficult. Now, what I noticed at that point was that a lot of the information that we were being given about stress in the field was very much focused on the sort of impact of the experiences we were having in the field. So, you know, we go to all sorts of workshops saying, you know, in aid work, you'll encounter these difficult things. You know, you'll be in conflict zones. You'll be faced with a lot of human suffering, and indeed those things did have an impact, but the focus seemed to be on that and how we're then supposed to, you know, deal with that and strategies for coping with that kind of field stress. But as I reflected on it, I began to realize that actually the things that were troubling me were not really so much to do with the things I was seeing in the field. I mean, in a sense, you know, I was prepared for that. I signed up for that. I was trained for that. You know, those things were things that I could expect. But a lot of the things I was struggling with, I realized, were actually to do with experiences that went far, far back in my life. A lot to do with some very early experiences in childhood and thereafter. And as I reflected, I then began to realize that perhaps, what was going on here was that I had chosen humanitarian work in part because it was actually a solution to those earlier difficulties. Does that make sense? Do you see what I'm saying? That rather than sort of being stressed out by the work, it was actually the decision to go into the humanitarian sector that I felt was some kind of solution to a lot of these early struggles. As you said in your introduction, humanitarian work can be a very powerful way of actually sort of dealing with difficulties. There's constant distraction, you're moving around a lot, you have real intensity in terms of the people that you meet. But it's really quite a successful way, when you think about it, of avoiding the real risks of intimacy, of getting close to people. So you have this kind of dilemma that on the one hand you're very much wanting those things, but one then sort of finds one's way to a life that actually sort of really avoids them. I think something I've learned in the research that I've carried out is, and I certainly know this from my own experience, is that there are all sorts of things that go on in humanitarian life that are very addictive. Well-known, obvious example of that is the whole idea of the adrenaline junkie. And, I think we can sort of point to people, the kind of humanitarian cowboys, and we think, oh, yes, they're the adrenaline junkies, not me. But I think that can manifest in quite subtle forms, in the sense that, it's constant stimulus. There's always something new. There's always something exciting, even if it's dangerous and even if it's upsetting. It can be, it's all very stimulating. So we that can be quite a distraction. But even the travel, moving from one place to another, can also have that same effect. I think we all know that in the field, lots of people hook up, lots of people drink too much. There are all sorts of ways in which the life of a humanitarian can become quite addictive. And certainly what I've discovered, I talk to a lot of humanitarians now as a therapist, and you almost get the same sense of people struggling with an addiction in that they're doing something that may have been good initially, but they're becoming increasingly aware that it's not good for them anymore. But then they want to stop. And I talk to tons of people saying, I'd like to go home, but it kind of scares me to give up this life. So in sort of quite interesting ways, it can start behaving quite like an addiction. It's difficult to give up. It's difficult to imagine a different kind of life, but over time, it has an increasingly sort of negative impact on one's life. We need to think more about what we're bringing to the field. What's gone in our lives that draws us to this kind of work, and if there are things that need sorting out, can we be helped to do that, before this life that we lead starts kind of getting bad for us?
We don't even realize until we come to this breaking point that it's like, I know myself, I wanted to work in this sector since I'm 16. I volunteered mm-hmm. and then I went abroad. But then I also realized when things got too busy and after years of working in the field and then, and demanding job when I was in headquarters in our office in Rome, I realized, first I thought it's exactly as you said. I said, I'm overwhelmed with my job. It's a lot of mm-hmm. stuff happening. But then I exactly ended up like what you're saying. I looked at my relationships. I had to go back to my childhood and looked at the issues in our family. So it's actually exactly as you said, like, you end up talking about first about work issues because you feel so overwhelmed and stressed. And then when you start that journey to reflect, to seek help, then you actually really end up talking about relationships and how you grew up and, you know, some of the issues that you had in your childhood, which I find just gives a whole new perspective actually on the AIDS sector. And maybe we did run away from certain problems. And I think it's what you're saying, our work is so powerful because we can focus on addressing other people's needs. We don't have to deal with our own pain. So I can really say that it's so true from my own journey. But it took a crisis to make me realize that and you know, look at that differently. So what would you say for people who kind of struggle, like, how can we, like, what can we do differently from the start that we don't have to hit rock bottom or, you know, be completely burned out to maybe turn around and do something differently? And I think you in your research, you talk about attachment theory to explain these relationship challenges that we maybe, you know, whoever is listening into this can learn from and think, okay, does that apply to me? Is that, you know, is that really me going from emergency to emergency? Is that something I need to consider? So what would, what helps instead of us, that it becomes bad? What can we do differently? Or what can help me understand maybe that's really something I actually am dealing with, relationship insecurities?
I think it's such an important point that you make. And I think it's still something that is really regrettable in the sector, that still, I think, even though there's so much more awareness about well-being and staff care on different levels, I mean, I think, you know, that the conversation has become a lot more sophisticated than it was even a few years ago, I think it's still the case that often people don't really get to start thinking deeply about these issues, basically until they've had a bit of a breakdown. You know, we get into this thing and we work. And so often it isn't until there's a crisis that we're sort of forced to think not just about our experiences in the field, but start asking, you know, in a sense, sort of much deeper questions. It's like, well, what brought me here? You know, what am I trying to solve by doing this? And I think it's, I mean, one thing I would want to keep saying is that, you know, I'm not here trying to say that, you know, all our motives are kind of somehow wrong and, you know, that actually all we're trying to do is kind of anesthetize our own pain, because, you know, I think we do come into the sector with very real values and goals and motivations, but then I think there's this whole piece that we kind of miss, you know, that could potentially really help us. I mean, I do think there could be much better structures in place to help us reflect on these issues. So, I mean, I think sometimes, you know, hard to see how this could work in practice sometimes, but, you know, I think there could be a lot more space, you know, during the recruitment process, in a sense, to help people think through, you know, what is bringing them to this work, you know, what's driving them. At basic training, you know, at induction, you know, I think along with just the sort of the regular kind of briefings on field stress, I think there could be a lot more done to help people think about, you know, their relational patterns, you know, what they've grown up with, you know, what they might be trying to avoid, you know, but I think there would be something really important trying to normalize that. I mean, I think we all do that to a degree, but I think we do need to take on board that humanitarian work is, in a sense, a particularly strong drug. I mean, I look at it like that sometimes. You know, it really is a powerful combination of things, you know, that we can get drawn to. And, you know, but if we had more chance to reflect, I mean, you're saying, yeah, you too, and I hear this over and over again, and eventually you got to a place where you were reflecting on your childhood, on you know, what brought you to the sector. You know, if we could do that earlier on in our careers, you know, I think that could help us adjust. It could help us kind of work through the things we need to work through. And ultimately, I think it could be very good for the sector, because it actually then means that perhaps people aren't burning out and breaking down so quickly. You know, they're able to keep going.
So you're basically saying just organizations creating more space and room to maybe create that awareness in the first place, because I think most of us are not really aware. We really go, as you said, with really good intentions. And only in my case, when, you know, I had a crisis, then I realized, oh, okay, like, yes, I'm still passionate about working in the sector. That's why I'm still around. But at the same time, yeah, it does bring us back to our childhood and relationship issues. So I wanted to also ask you, because you really, when you talk about some of the issues like, you know, preventing really burnout, you actually say, let's really look at like some of the old wounds we had, relationship issues, and you apply attachment theory in your research. Can you talk a little bit more what that is and why it's so relevant in the humanitarian sector?
Because I think attachment theory really does help us understand an awful lot about, you know, what motivates us, but also about how we sort of behave in response to stress and threat. So I as we said, I was in the field for quite a long time. I then realized I was becoming sort of, in a sense, I mean, not that I wasn't interested in the beneficiaries, but I was becoming much more interested in the people delivering the aid than the people receiving it. And I was trying to think, well, you know, I was having my own sort of struggles, but I was really trying to sort of think a lot more about, you know, what's driving people here. So I came back to the UK and retrained as a therapist, but very quickly found my way to attachment theory. Which I could give you a little basic sort of explanation that many people might be familiar with it, but it's basically a whole kind of body of theoretical writing, clinical case studies, research that maps out basically how we are in relationship. It was developed in the 60s and the 70s by a British psychologist called John Bowlby and his colleague Mary Ainsworth. And they, well, Bowlby certainly had started out life as a classical Freudian psychoanalyst, if I'm right there. But he became really interested in how we interact with our closest caregivers. And they together began to develop almost a system of classification to look at sort of styles of relating, but how those then sort of how we carry those into adult life and how they shape us. So just kind of very briefly, I mean, they identified a category which they called secure attachment. And so for those lucky enough to be securely attached, They saw that when children, very young children, are really kind of, when their parents seem to really understand their needs, when they feel that they are kind of receiving really consistent and available caregiving, we grow up then developing a sense of deep security about who we are and about our place in the world. So you know, when we feel that we've had very sort of consistent and available care growing up, so that means, you know, if we've been upset, if there's somebody there to talk to, if we feel that people have really been wanting to understand what's going on for us, you know, the message that you get growing up is, you know, I'm worth knowing. You know, it also means that when we encounter something difficult, and this is where attachment theory really does, in a sense, become almost a theory of threat management, interestingly. But when we're securely attached and we encounter something difficult, we basically know, or we feel confident, that we can reach out to other people. We can talk about our difficulties. We can work through them. We can find support, and we get to carry on. So, you know, insecure attachment, you know, in a sense, we're talking about resilience. And of course, that has huge implications for the aid sector, you know, because you're living in very difficult environments. And if you feel confident that the people are there to support you, you know, you'll be able to cope with a lot of stress, put simply. What they also mapped out, though, is that when we don't receive the kind of consistent and available caregiving that we might need, we have to adapt in different ways. So we develop different strategies for coping with life. That can go in two different directions. So we either become what they called anxiously attached. Now, for those folks, you're not sure that people are there for you. So you've got to kind of grab hold of them. In a sense, that's you know, we would understand that as being quite kind of clingy behaviors. So you know, people who get very worried about what people think of them, they kind of grab a hold of them. They want to be sure that they're safe. In the other direction, we have what they call avoidant attachment. So for those folks, they've basically realized growing up that there aren't really reliable people around them. So the avoidantly attached tend to then really minimize their own needs. They kind of say, well, you know, I'm all right on my own. Other people aren't really reliable. So I'm going to do my own thing, and I don't need anyone. Now, you know, both of those can show up in different ways in the humanitarian sector. You know, I mean, I think, you know, there's lots of talk, isn't there, about sort of macho tough guy culture in aid. And I think, in a sense, we could see that as a very clear manifestation of avoidant attachment. You know, it's basically I'm tough, I'm autonomous. You know, I don't need anyone. On the more anxious side, I mean, that could show up in aid as well in different ways. Often in the form of, you know, what in attachment they call compulsive caregiving. So that means that you kind of deal with your own kind of relational insecurities by kind of latching on to other people's needs. So, you know, you get drawn to people who are vulnerable and require help. And that gives you a sense of kind of importance. It gives you a sense of value. But it also kind of helps soothe your own kind of worries about your own significance. Both of those, I think, do show up in different ways in the aid sector, and both of them in different ways, you know, can end up having very negative consequences. Of course, you know, when people sort of keep going in those sort of modes, you know, they get really worn out, because, you know, you're trying to cope with life without sort of the most basic thing that we need, which is other people. You know, one way or another, you're steering clear of you know, close, nourishing relationships, because, you know, one way or another, those feel too risky. Now, going back to what we were saying earlier on, you know, I think if people were helped to, in a sense, kind of evaluate where they stand on that spectrum much earlier on, you know, you can really begin to help people put better measures in place. You can help people understand, you know, where their vulnerable points are. You can help people find their way to kind of much healthier support structures. This isn't just a question of kind of, you know, good staff care. I mean, this is about, I think, the quality of the work, because, you know, if you've got people who are essentially more secure, you know, if you've got people who are sort of less anxious or less shut off, you know, they are inevitably going to be able to sort of engage much more creatively. They're going to be much more present to the actual task in hand. You know, they're actually going to be thinking about the beneficiaries in a way that, that sort of keeps the focus on them. It's, it doesn't become just a kind of strategy to help themselves. This works on different levels, both in terms of personal well-being, but I think it really does translate into much more effective practice.
I discovered over my own journey that, yeah, my issues that I had to deal with that came out in my own attachment style, I distracted myself as well with focusing on other people's needs. Mm-hmm. So I always felt so good when someone needed me. You know, I was like, oh my God, someone is asking for my advice. And, you know, and with the aid sector, I basically turned it into a career to be needed all the time. And we don't really ask for help when we actually need it the most, when we have a stressful day or we work for a month in an emergency and need a break. We don't have good strategies to cope. And so we, because of that attachment style, I realized, yeah, I eventually was at a great risk of burnout and really struggling to have a balance. Now for people listening in, if, you know, for them to think about, okay, what style do I have? How do I cope? What are my strategies? Like, do I easily seek help from people, say, oh, I'm not feeling well, you know, I need to talk to someone or I need to speak to a counselor, or maybe I need to take a longer break. And then the other part is also really what I realized is because you have that wound and that attachment style from your childhood, you help others, which was for me a tough pill to swallow, because that's how you cope. That's how you receive love or approval. And once you go through that process, you become aware, then actually you become like much more secure in yourself. You feel much more comfortable asking other people. And then I think because you're much more whole with yourself, you can then really be present with other people's need and feel even compassion. And I feel then when you become more secure, you can really, that's when the real impact is actually coming, because you're balanced, you've filled your own cup, you feel secure within yourself. So I find, yeah, what you're saying is I think so true. I can totally see that in my own journey. And if we do tackle those issues around our attachment style, we will do such a better job at addressing other people's concerns. But can you say that, you know, is that a born attachment style that we have? Like, we're born insecure? Is there something like, or you think we can really, over time, we can change that?
Certainly in the early years of attachment theory, some people, I think, rightly were slightly critical of it, because what they felt was that this was a very sort of deterministic theory, essentially saying that, you know, if you've grown up in a particular kind of environment where you perhaps haven't had the kind of ideal level of caregiving, you know, that you're somehow then kind of forced into this particular attachment style, and then that's you for the rest of your life. But you know, I think Bowlby himself was insistent that actually that was not the case. You know, you weren't sort of consigned to a particular way of relating. And actually, you know, as the years have gone on, and I mean, there is now, you know, a truly vast amount of research on this. Certainly, what we've learned is that, you know, your attachment style is really much more flexible than I think had even initially been thought. There's a lovely phrase they call it earned security. What they mean by that is actually, even, you know, once we perhaps realize and are able to identify the ways in which our attachment style is insecure, once we can understand, you know, in a sense where the wounds lie, you know, there are all sorts of things we can do that can shift that. Pretty much all of those things are to do with relationships. You know, we are fundamentally relational beings. So, you know, if we find that we've got caught up in a particular way of relating, and I think that's, you know, that's certainly what happens. You know, we get into quite predictable patterns, and, you know, you're saying yourself, you know, you could see how you got caught up in something. The sort of act of helping others kind of made you feel valuable and worthwhile, and that kind of drove you forwards. But of course, you know, that eventually leads to a bit of burnout because it means exhausting doing that. But what we now know is that, you know, when people realize that and then kind of look for the kind of secure relationships that might help them sort of rework some of that, you know, it becomes very possible to shift. Now, seeing someone like me is one way of doing that, and, you know, that's the work that I do with quite a lot of people, actually, is in a sense helping folks to address those insecurities and move towards a kind of more settled and a more secure way of relating. People find, you know, mentors, peer support groups, you know, they say there is counseling, there's mentoring. There are online forums now where people get together and talk about, you know, what's going on. And I think people are much more willing now to be more honest and open about the struggles. I think organizations have a real role to play in facilitating that. It's all very well saying to staff, well, you know, you need to do all, this is what used to frustrate me about, you know, resilience workshops and things, because, you know, you'd say to people, well, here are all the things you need to do to be resilient, but there wouldn't be much attention paid to what the organization needs to do to help people. And so, I mean, I think there's all sorts of things that organizations can do in terms of making those resources available. But, you know, absolutely, it is possible to move from a place of insecurity to something that feels much, much more secure. And I couldn't agree more with what you're saying in that, you know, what you then discover is that you're not, you know, you're in the field and you're working with beneficiaries, but in a sense, you're not sort of using them to sort of make yourself feel better. You know, you're actually secure enough to perhaps sort of put yourself out of the picture for a moment and genuinely attend to what's in front of you. People notice that, you know, it's a very different experience when people feel they're being really listened to and heard. And the responses become then, you know, much more sort of attuned to what the real needs are. But yes, it's absolutely possible to get there. It just requires a bit of work.
No, but it gives us hope, so we can change our habits. But I think what I found in the beginning of my own journey, contradictory, and now looking back, it's like we have to address, we have to do a little bit of inner work. We have to address our own issues, our pain that we're getting, that we want to, you know, shy away from, not look at it, distract ourselves with, you know, and as you said, the humanitarian sector is very powerful to help us with our addictions, to not look at our pain. But I think when you do that inner work, you are at a much better place. You are healthier, you're more balanced, you easily seek help, you have an environment that really supports you. So I think that the whole journey really would bring us all to a very different and more and healthier and better place where we can even perform on a much different level, and we shouldn't feel ashamed to seek help. Or sometimes I think it's still a taboo because we feel like, oh, I'm weak and I can't deal with the challenges. But I think it's very clear that the sector is unusual anyways, because we work a lot. But yeah, it's really important to, as you said, to go to someone like you or join groups to talk about it. But if you would say, like, someone who's listening in, who's now trying to understand, is that me? Do I struggle with relationships? Is that really an addiction that I have from one emergency to the next? You know, if people like now start analyzing their own issues, what would you say is kind of the first step that we could take?
The first step is in a sense to start sort of paying attention to yourself and in a sense taking that seriously. You know, I think, and I know this from my own experience, you know, we can go for a very long time in the field feeling that sort of something's not quite right. You know, I think I went for a very long time just sort of somehow assuming that at some point it would all sort of work out. I'll go to another mission, or I'll move to another country, or I'll you know, meet someone new, and then all will be well. So whilst, you know, we certainly don't want to be kind of just sort of obsessed with ourselves in a kind of paranoid way, you know, I do think sort of really paying attention to those concerns, you know, when we do feel kind of lonely, or we do feel that somehow, you know, we're not at peace with ourselves, you know, I think that's absolutely key. Starting simple is find someone you care and who cares about you and talk to them about it. You know, ask someone, you know, ask them what they see in you. You know, I mean, that can be a risky step. But, you know, sitting down with a close friend or a trusted colleague, you know, what I found again and again and again is that even if though people might feel slightly nervous about talking about these issues, you know, if you can open up space and make that sort of seem, if that can be an acceptable thing to do, you know, people jump at the chance because it's, you know, there's so much that gets kind of bottled up. I think there's lots more to read these days. I mean, I think you spoke to Gemma Hooldy recently on your podcast, who just brought out a book called The Vulnerable Humanitarian. You know, great place to start. A colleague of mine is editing a book that's coming out later this year, which I'm contributing a chapter to that, called Psychological Support for Workers on the Move. That's going to be coming out this year. I think, you know, there are all sorts of good books out there now on relationships and attachment theory that can be a sort of really helpful sort of introduction. You know, you just have a read of something and just and use it as a tool for reflection. You know, is this me? Do I recognize myself here? In terms of counselors and therapists now who work specifically in the humanitarian space, I mean, I think there are many, many more now than there used to be. I mean, when I started out, it felt like it was quite a sort of small little niche specialism, whereas these days, I think there are many more mental health professionals out there who aren't really understand what goes on for humanitarians, you know, both in terms of, you know, the very positive motivations to do the work, and perhaps also in terms of the more kind of problematic, slightly more addictive, compulsive drives that play out. There are lots more resources out there than there used to be. But I come back to this to this thought of take it seriously and don't wait until you're feeling completely burnt out. Don't wait for the morning where you wake up and you think, I just can't do this anymore. You know, take those concerns seriously. It's a real act of resilience in itself to be prepared to look into one's own history and really ask oneself, well, okay, so what are the wounds that I'm carrying? You know, where does my pain sit? And do I need to do something about that? There's lots out there now, and my hope is that the more we all do this together, you know, the more the culture in the sector really does shift. You know, the more organizations begin to sort of perhaps really embed the kind of structures in terms of both kind of briefing, debriefing, consistent counseling support, forums where people can just get together and talk, peer support. You know, there's so much you can do that makes space for this. But it does really begin with being able to acknowledge that the issue exists, and then, you know, one can take it from there.
We often don't trust our gut or our feelings, mm-hmm. to say, you know, something is really off. I don't. And no matter how much I sleep, I still wake up tired, I doubt my work, myself. I think that's exactly the point where we're like, oh, okay, something is off, and maybe I can read, I can ask someone, I can talk to a friend, like, how have you recently viewed me? Am I stressed? What do you think? You know, I think that's such a great piece of advice. So we don't need to really wait until we break out. We need to kind of tune in again to how we feel and what our gut is telling us, and not march on. As you said, I think that's, yeah. And even for other people who might not be in the same situation, but see other people who are maybe often stressed, short-tempered, you know, that could also be a sign that someone is not doing well, and just checking in with them to say, hey, how are you doing? How are things at work? Yeah. And that over time will will certainly open up new conversations and change the culture. And as you said, you know, there's so much more resources now and staff counselors are available. So I think we're also in that space where we have those resources available and can contribute to a safer place where we feel we can have better relationships and a more balanced life. So thank you so much, Mark. That brings us to the end of our podcast. It was such a fascinating conversation, a completely new angle to the sector. Instead of blaming it on my boss, it has more to do actually with, you know, how we learn to cope with difficult circumstances in our childhood, and you know, how the sector sometimes with its addiction can help us distract ourselves from our own pain. I think that's such a really complete new angle, and I think brings a lot of understanding to why some of these issues don't go away, or why going to the next emergency you know, will not help us actually deal with our stress and the lack of maybe some inner peace. So thanks so much, Mark, for joining us today.
Good pleasure. Thank you.
So for everyone who's tuning in, this podcast you can find on my website, marikagudarian.com. It's also available on Spotify, Apple, or Google Podcasts, and where I host monthly podcasts with inspiring guests such as Mark and from all around the world. And you can also find the previous episodes there. And thanks for listening in. And until next month, when we meet again.